However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in 5 gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said, Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they are not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action. More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battle fronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020 under a UN brokered deal, while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations.
The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the coronavirus resurges in Iran, domestic biotech firms are in a race against time to get a vaccine to the market. Among the 8 viable candidates, Coviran is now ahead in the race. Produced by the headquarters for executing Imam Khomeini's order, the vaccine started its first phase of the human trials in December last year. And now, as developers say, the first step was a success.
The first phase was to test whether or not the vaccine is safe to be injected to everyone. So we inoculated 56 volunteers in 2 stages, and the good news is no one has displayed any serious side effect as a result of the jabs.
2 more phases are left for the vaccine to get the ultimate approval. In the second phase, 400 volunteers will get the jabs. This time, the aim is to assess how much immunity the vaccine will make against the virus.
In the second phase, we are going to have something like 400 people, 100 between 50 and 75, the average of the age, and the other 300 above 18 and until 50. If we could, we will get emergency permit like other vaccines to combine phase 2 and 3.
While the UK variant of the coronavirus has reached Iran, experts say the Iranian vaccine is effective against the mutated virus.
This vaccine is whole virus that is inactivated. And that's why if there is any more mutation in the virus, this whole virus vaccines may be more effective than those that have just a simple antigen or whatever.
Earlier this month, Iran unveiled another homegrown vaccine dubbed COVPARS, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. Administered through injection and inhalation, COVPARS is an mRNA recombinant vaccine that reconstructs a harmless piece of the virus's spike protein. The second batch of Russia's Sputnik V arrived in Iran last week amid an ongoing voluntary vaccination in the country. Iran's government says it does not favor Iranian vaccines over foreign counterparts, and the priority is to start the nationwide vaccination campaign as soon as possible.
Now that the COVID-19 vaccine has proved safe for mass vaccination, the next step is to test its efficacy. Experts say this will be made clear in the second phase of the human trial, which will kickstart in almost a month. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian refugees in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of UNRWA aid distribution centers against cuts to vital services and assistance by the UN agency. UNRWA provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. As of Sunday, UNRWA implemented further aid cuts to Palestinian refugees, citing budget deficit, but Palestinians maintain that cuts are merely political.
These cuts are purely political and have nothing to do with the budget deficit. Palestinian refugees will continue to fight these conspiracies against the Palestinians and their rights until we achieve the right of return. UNRWA must stop these measures that aim to undermine the issue of refugees and the Palestinian cause.
The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis deepened after former U.S. President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
UNRWA has been cutting back its services over the years. What they gave us today is not enough to feed our families. Every time we get less food items. Today they gave me a small bag of sugar, which is barely enough to make tea for a few days. We are extremely poor and we want UNRWA to restore all of our food aid in order for us to survive.
The vast majority of Gazans are refugees who were kicked out of their towns and villages upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948. Palestinian refugees who suffered for more than seven decades say UNRWA cuts will only increase their plight amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The cuts come at a time that Palestinian refugees are suffering the worst humanitarian conditions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. UNRWA must increase aid instead of cutting it. Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip are extremely poor and are the worst hit by these cuts.
Over 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip, and their hardships have increased under the Israeli blockade.
Palestinian refugees say that as long as they are displaced and dispossessed, UNRWA should provide them with all due services without any cuts. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing their refusal of the recent normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress their rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refused any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause, and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end these normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations.
Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, "I will not make that happen," and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders.
I have $28,000 in student debt. Under capitalism, like, college can be a very predatory thing. You're betting the rest of your life to, like, being able to make these payments. And this is going to create more distrust for the Democrats. This is going to embolden more people that might be Republican that also have a lot of student debt to not trust this person.
The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first. and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Greetings and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed in his recent speech that the Islamic Republic is not seeking nukes, while at the same time it won't dispense with the nation's right to utilize peaceful nuclear energy. He also reminded the fact that Iran believes in the slogan, nuclear energy for all, nuclear bombs for no one. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iran would have nuclear weapons today if it had wished to have them. He stressed that it's the Islamic ideology that bans all forms of mass destruction weapons. Now the question is, if the West is really concerned about Tehran accessing nukes, why did they not stick to the 2015 nuclear deal? The U.S. even scrapped it altogether. Now we'll watch a report and then discuss the issue.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the US withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said, Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Now, that was the report. Now, let me invite our guests to this debate show. We have Director of the Salah Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi, joining us out of the Iranian city of Qom, and also a journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, out of London. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Qom. Sam, world powers reached a nuclear deal with Iran after marathon negotiations, and then when it came to implementation, the U.S. left it altogether, while Iran remained in full compliance for more than a year, as you know. So in what context do you assess Washington's departure from what Europeans call a landmark accord?
Well, Berzhan, we've talked about this many times before. There was an attempt over 30 years by elites in Iran to so-called normalize relations, normalize economic relations with the West. We even heard this in the interview that Dr. Zarif had with Press TV a couple of days ago, that he mentioned three goals. Out of the JCPOA, he said, making the enrichment, Iranian enrichment, official under international law, ending Iran's securitization, and the final goal was to normalize economic relations. Well, this is something that did not happen in reality, and it was never going to happen. The point is that there was a belief among Iranian elites, many of them, not all of them, that there could be something called normal economic relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the West, not understanding that the relations between Iran and the West over the last 200, 300 years have been predatory. So there's no such thing for the West as normal relations. So we've now come to this end of this process after 20, 30 years. We made our best effort. The whole world saw that Iran is willing to give up part of its strategic capabilities, in this case, as it relates to nuclear technology, for this thing that was called normal economic relations, which, again, as I mentioned, is something that was never really going to happen. And this process now has come to an end. It failed on the ground, and the Americans were never going to, whether it was Obama or Trump or Biden or whoever else might come in the future, were ever going to establish normal economic relations with Iran.
Okay, now let me turn to London. Said Mohsen Abbas, Tehran is saying that it could have nukes if it wanted to, as I mentioned in intro. But the thing is that even if we want to move in that direction, Islam won't allow it. So on what ground is the West crying wolf when it comes to Iran's nuclear activity?
It's crying wolf on the ground that they're under instructions, essentially, from forces behind the scenes. One of those forces is obviously Israel. The other one, arguably, is the moneylender mafia, which pretty much controls the economic and military and political gain globally. The fact of the matter is that these guys, like Biden or Netanyahu, are ultimately puppets and levers of power, if you like. So, to be honest, these guys are the messengers. They deliver the message which the global powers that be want implemented. The problem for them is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the only nations now left that isn't part of the Bank of International Settlements, not part of that, if you like, control mechanism that they want. It doesn't comply with the values and the ethics and the morality, whatever that is. I mean, in fact, it's a non-existent morality. And Ayatollah Khamenei re-emphasizing his religious commitment to not having nuclear weapons is significant for a Muslim or for somebody who understands morality. It has no significance for these folk because they don't have any intention of being truthful in any policy that they roll out. All of their policies are based on economic, if you like, priorities, which will always, always, always trump ethics and morality. So you're dealing with an essentially immoral beast, and Imam Khamenei knows this. Just give you an example. Earlier this month, French President Emmanuel Macron pitched himself as an honest broker between the Biden administration and Tehran. But he also insisted that the countries such as Israel and Saudi Arabia should be involved in talks. You know, as if Israel and Saudi Arabia are some sort of neutral party, and as if Israel isn't already violating the nuclear, if you like, situation globally. It's accountable to nobody. Over 400 nuclear weapons pointed probably mainly at Iran, and it's continuously causing trouble. Saudi Arabia is its kind of clandestine puppet as well. This is the problem. This is the insight which the Assembly of Experts today, who Imam Khamenei addressed, knows. They've managed to keep imperialism off the soil of Iran since the revolution. That is going to stick in the gullet of the powers that be, and they will not really abide by any agreement. You've seen it already collapse once. What's to say that when Biden goes out of power, even if he were to agree to something with Iran now, which is highly, highly unlikely, what's to say that they won't just renege on their deals? They're known for it. It's a common practice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, Sam, Iran's nuclear activity has undergone the largest number of international inspections, multiple reports put forward by the IAEA, all confirming the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activity. Tehran has not benefited from the nuclear deal, but still allows the IAEA inspections to go on, except for that voluntary part of the initial protocol. Isn't this indicative of Iran's goodwill?
Of course it is. And again, we have to remember a couple of things here, Behrouz. One is that everything that Iran has been doing is completely legal under international law, is now, by the law that was passed by the Majlis, incumbent and obligatory on the executive branch to fulfill it. So as far as legally and morally, I think we don't need to keep repeating that Iran has the moral high ground, that Iran has the right. We need to get beyond this. This is a fact. It's established. Everybody knows it. The only problem is that countries like the European countries, which, you know, claim to be very civilized and sophisticated, but the reality is that they do not dare to speak against the country that won World War II and has been occupying them for 70 years. This is the reality of Europe. And I go back that all of this discussion goes back to a incorrect understanding among some Iranian elites of the realities that exist in the world. They thought that they could have a thing called normal relations with the West. This basically does not exist. There is no such thing as normal relations with Western powers. There's no such thing as normal relations with America. So there was an attempt by certain Iranian elites after the war, around the personality of the late Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani, to get this thing going. They've been trying it for 20 years. Everybody, including the Supreme Leader, has said, fine, go do it, let's see what happens. It is now, we have now experienced this on the ground empirically, that it's not going to happen. And of course, the biggest problem with this understanding is that there might have been some way of justifying this understanding 30 years ago, 1990, 1989, 1991, mm-hmm. that there was only, you know, the West or America. But the world in 2020, 2021 is very different than 1990. There's a lot of other economic powers in the world which Iran can cooperate with. And the most important thing is that Iran itself has much more powerful and much more economically capable than it was 30 years ago. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. these elites were able to have the policy decision-making in the country in a way control it or in a way influence it that allowed them greater power than the reality of what was on the ground. So now all of this has happened. Iran has shown its good faith internationally. Right. Iran has allowed the democratic processes within Iran to take shape. Governments get elected, get reelected, new governments come into play, the people decide what they want to do, and so this process has now come to its natural end. It's very unlikely that this administration is going to end this process because this is all they had to offer in these 8 years when they came. So probably what will happen is that in the beginning of the summer when we have a new administration in Iran, this process is going to end in a more official and in a more significant way than we see it today.
Okay. Now, Said Mohsen, the Islamic Republic regards use of weapons of mass destruction an unforgivable sin. So to that, it's even raised this initiative called the Middle East Free from Chemical Weapons. What Iran insists to continue is the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Every country is right. So what's wrong with that?
I think it's a fantastic initiative, and I think that this is where the Islamic Republic of Iran has to bat from. They've got to stop, as my colleague was saying, stop looking to the West for frameworks, for solutions, for ideas, not be bedazzled by the technical advancement or the kind of military advancements they've had over the last century or two or longer, and actually start turning, as they are doing, internally to their own source of intellectual and creative, if you like, advancement. And I think that part of that, quality that the Iranians do have, it's something that they need to acknowledge to themselves, is that they have a moral infrastructure, a framework which can build these kinds of ideas, you know, give the world solutions to the problems which neo-capitalism, neoliberalism, hyper-capitalism of the West has gifted us with. Look, we're facing a world where an economic reset, a global economic reset, is being engineered by those very powers which have raped and pillaged not only the East, far more of the East and Africa and that part of the globe, but they've also been subjugating and, if you like, controlling the people in the West with all sorts of amazingly destructive notions, like, for instance, their ideas around, for instance, feminism. We could put other things on the table that are there in terms of gender fluidity, the whole moral morass, which is picked up here. All of this has been gifted by the powers that be that are pushing out these ideologies. How long, if these elites, which my colleague talked about, do constantly look to the West for some sort of direction as to where Iran should go, or in terms of following their lead on this JCPOA or following their lead on other matters? Well, to be honest with you, I think you're looking at a sort of an empire in recession, in collapse, and it really is a credit to Iran that even in this economic, if you like, terrorism phase that we've seen, especially over the last decade, rolled out against Iran, what's Iran done? There are more university students coming out of those universities, which wasn't existent under the Shah, for instance. There are more accelerations in aerospace technology. There's been an advancement in moving away from oil and reliance on gas only to actually using the resources of Iran on a wider field. This self-sustainability, this turning more to the East, if you're going to look for any backup, is the way forward. And I think that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm afraid the Western system is fundamentally opposed not only to Iran, it's opposed to its Islamic revolutionary ideology. It's opposed to the morality that revolution potentially stands for, and it doesn't want any of that to be, if you like, filtered into the rest of the globe. So therefore, it's obliged to try and do everything it can to destroy Iran, trying to make a friend out of a wolf for any animal that actually is on its dinner menu is naive and foolish.
Right. Okay, Sam, the United States, as you know, possesses the largest arsenal of lethal and mass destruction weapons. It's even used them against other countries. So how can it expand its nuclear arsenal at the same time expect others to get rid of them?
Well, like I said, I mean, these discussions are, you know, something that are so basic and elementary, I don't think we need to waste our time on these issues. The reality is that it's not about international law. It's not about, you know, agreements and so on and so forth. I mean, yes, they have a certain place, maybe as a marginal issue. The whole UN system is a tool, as the Westerners see the UN system and the Americans see the UN system as a tool of, you know, expanding their own power and projecting their own power. So I think this is a problem that some of the people in Iran have, is that they actually believe the things that they read in the books in terms of international relations and international law. I mean, it's very different, the reality of what the world is, from what it is in the books. International law is a very narrow concept, and it is used and seen by Western powers as a tool of their own power. So there's no point in us trying to really, you know, look at this as a way of salvation or trying a way to figure out how the world we're going to govern that. I understand Dr. Zarif as an international lawyer making narrow arguments under international law. I understand that. Mm-hmm. This is something that, as an academic, I get it. But this is a very different issue than what the reality of the politics of the world is. Yes, it's true. According to the, you know, UN resolution, Iran now officially can enrich. But why do we even have to go there? Why did we even have to you know, go into that position where, you know, that we have to say that this is a victory? I believe that this is changing the goalposts after the fact.
Okay.
The goal of the JCPOA, as stated by the Supreme Leader, was getting rid of the sanctions on Iran. It has not happened, and it will never happen under the JCPOA.
Okay.
The whole point of the JCPOA was to create a framework for Iran and the West to talk, so that the West could start talking about Iran's strategic military capabilities, such as missiles and nuclear energy and other things and whatever else it wants to add in the future.
Okay.
Well, we tried it. We showed good faith. We were even willing to compromise for a certain amount of time on our strategic capabilities. It did not happen. Let's move on.
Okay, good. Now, Said Mohsen, one last question. We have very little time for that. Recently, we have had satellite images showing even further activity at the Dimona nuclear facility used by the Tel Aviv regime. Who's posing a threat to regional peace?
Well, if you want to look at the Yinon plan, which Israel has been working on ever since the 60s and perhaps even before that, if you want to look at the number of U.S. bases that are dotted around all around the Middle East, and particularly now lining up all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, if you want to look at the interference in Syria and of British and American forces prior to the war that was initiated by themselves, if you want to look at ISIS and Daesh and the inability to finish them off completely, that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you want to look at Iraq and its kind of, if you like, total decimation and destruction, all roads lead to Tel Aviv and Washington, D.C. There are no other routes. The rest of them, the London, the German capitals, they are like tails of a dog, and they wag according to whatever the main beast wants. So
I've got to jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much for your comments. We had Director of Risala, the Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehtetrabi from Qom, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London. Thank you for watching this debate show. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The loss of lean tissue when you diet, which burns around 15 to 25 calories per kilogram each day, lowers resting metabolic rate, meaning you need fewer calories than you previously did. But the body also deliberately slows down metabolism to preserve energy stores and minimize weight loss. When the body senses depleted fat stores, it triggers adaptive thermogenesis, a process which further reduces resting metabolic rate and may stunt weight loss despite strict dieting. Here we present you an article in this regard written jointly by Adam Collins, a principal teaching fellow in nutrition, and Ayuf Egan, a researcher in mathematical modeling of weight loss, who are both from University of Surrey, the UK, titled Dieting May Slow Metabolism But It Doesn't Ruin It. This article was published on theconversation.com. Please stay tuned. When it comes to dieting, research shows the majority of people will regain some, if not most, of the weight they've lost. While there are many reasons why this weight regain may happen, some popular claims online are that it's because dieting permanently wrecks your metabolism. But while it's true that dieting slows your metabolism, it also improves your metabolism in many positive ways. When we talk about metabolism, we are typically referring to your metabolic rate. This is the number of calories your body burns at rest. Of course, the more activity we do, the more calories we burn. In order to lose weight through dieting, you need to consume fewer calories than you're using. This forces the body to use its energy stores, like fat, to meet the shortfall. Your metabolic rate will also change as a result. The loss of lean tissue, that is muscle, when you diet, which burns around 15 to 25 calories per kilogram each day, lowers resting metabolic rate, meaning you need fewer calories than you previously did. But the body also deliberately slows down metabolism to preserve energy stores and minimize weight loss. When the body senses depleted fat stores, it triggers adaptive thermogenesis, a process which further reduces resting metabolic rate, and many stunt weight loss despite strict dieting. Adaptive thermogenesis can kick in within 3 days of starting a diet, and is suggested to persist way beyond dieting, even hampering weight maintenance and favoring weight regain. One example of adaptive thermogenesis effect was seen in a widely publicized 2016 study which looked at former contestants of US reality TV show The Biggest Loser. It showed that participants had a significant decrease in their metabolic rate even several years after initial weight loss. Participants needed to eat up to 500 calories less than expected daily. Other studies have also shown metabolic slowing with weight loss, but with much smaller decreases, around 100 calories fewer a day to maintain weight. However, there is less certainty whether this slowing persists once people are weight stable. Research seems to show that most adaptive thermogenesis happens in the actual dieting phase as a temporary response to the amount of weight being lost. Overall, we don't have conclusive evidence to support the notion that metabolic rate remains slowed over the long term, over a year post-diet. It's worth noting that many factors can affect metabolic rate, so changes to it after dieting may vary between people. For example, one study on fasting diets showed metabolic rate indeed decreases as a result, but those who had the greatest decrease in metabolic rate already had a higher metabolic rate to begin with. Overestimating metabolic rates at the start of a study or errors in predicting metabolic rate after weight loss could both also affect study results. It's agreed that metabolic rate slows because of weight loss due to both decreasing body size and as a way of preserving key tissues and fuel reserves. But there is currently no consensus on how much it slows by. Adam Collins and Afe Egan wrote, "Quantifying and predicting this slowing is something we are currently researching at the University of Surrey." However, a decrease in metabolic rate is just one change that occurs with weight loss. When we lose weight, the main change we see is a decrease in body fat. This decrease is actually our fat cells shrinking in size. They don't actually disappear. This shrinking of fat cells signals the body's fuel stores are emptying, causing a drop in the hormone leptin. Ordinarily, leptin inhibits appetite and increases metabolic rate. But when leptin levels plummet, metabolic rate is slow and hunger increases. The gut also releases fewer insulins, hormones which regulate appetite, when we lose weight, which could persist beyond dieting. Less leptin and fewer insulins may make us feel hungrier and can lead to overeating. When fat cells shrink, they are able to take up glucose and store fat more efficiently to help restore lost fuel. Your body also creates more fat cells so that you can store more fat in the future to better cope with this calorie crisis the next time it happens. But as contradictory as it sounds, all these changes actually result in a more efficient and ultimately healthier metabolism. For example, smaller fat cells are better for our health, as overinflated sick fat cells don't work as well in getting rid of surplus sugar and fat. This can lead to high levels of sugar and fat in the blood, increasing risk of insulin resistance, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. So, dieting doesn't technically ruin your metabolism, but rather improves it by helping it work better. But without care, this metabolic improvement can conspire against you to regain the weight and even overshoot your original weight. Studies show exercise or simply physical activity may be one way to prevent weight regain by improving our ability to maintain our weight and can potentially minimize metabolic slowing. Exercise can also help regulate appetite and fuel burning in the short term and may make weight loss more sustainable in the long term.
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.